again?
I'm ready when you are.
All right, cool. I've been recording this entire time.
What? Well, how long are we at?
We've been talking about poop.
Ten minutes.
Madison, when you do this, it takes forever.
I'm sorry. There's some pauses. Here, we can give it a nice long pause here, and then we can hop into it. How about that? Would that make it easy for you?
Yeah.
Okay.
This is Be Createful, a podcast about finding fullness through creativity. I'm Joe.
And I'm Madison. And today on episode 88, we are talking about cross-cultural creativity. And we have a very special guest with us today. So I'm going to go ahead and let her introduce herself and just give us the lowdown about you.
On what makes you qualified to come speak about cross-cultural creativity particularly?
My name is Rachel Howell, and I am happy to be here with you guys today. And I lived from between ages 25 and 40, I lived overseas. And I think I'm really creative.
So can you tell us where you lived?
I lived in Mozambique, which is on the southeast side of Africa. So that was
what countries are around it?
Down in the southern end, it touches South Africa.
Okay.
And way up in the northern end, which is where we lived, it touches Tanzania. So it covers a whole lot of coast. It's kind of a long, skinny country. Used to be colonized by the Portuguese. So Portuguese is the trade language, the national language.
Okay.
And then there's multiple local languages.
So how many languages did you have to learn to be there?
We had to learn Portuguese first, and then we learned the local language, which is called Makua Meto. It's Makua. There's like five, six, seven different Makua languages, so we learned one of those, which is called Meto.
So is the Meto like the different tribes that would speak it, or like the region, or where does that part come from? The Meto, where does that come from?
Yeah, that was one dialect within like the umbrella category of Makua languages.
Okay.
So there were six or seven, maybe, different Makua languages. So if we drove, you know, 6 hours away south to, like, the big city down there, you know, people there would listen to us and they would say, oh, that's the Makua of Pemba, you know, like our regional name. So, yeah.
So can the different dialects of Makua understand each other? Like how in English we can understand someone from Scotland, but maybe not very well?
Totally. But it'd be more, instead of like British English and American English, a closer analogy would be maybe between Spanish and Portuguese. Maybe.
Gotcha.
Or like Spanish and Italian or something like that. So.
Okay. Language fascinates me.
Yeah. It's super fun and super nerdy, and I just really like it.
I'm not good at it. And then my perfectionist tendencies and my need to be the best really keep me from opening my mouth in a different language because I don't want to mess up.
Oh, you have to be willing to make a whole lot of mistakes, and you have to be willing to be laughed at sometimes by children saying, you know, you didn't say that right, you know. But the times when I make a mistake in language, it sticks a lot faster.
Right.
Than, like, just looking at a flashcard and trying to use it out in the community. It takes a lot longer for it to stick. But if I get corrected, it'll stick really fast.
So how long was it that y'all were there before you felt like you were able to have good conversations with people in Makua?
Years.
Yeah.
Years. You know, when we were getting ready to go do what we were doing over there, we were told to spend 2 years learning language and culture. We were told to do 2 years language and culture and, like, try and not do any, like, work in that 2 years because you don't know what you're doing. You don't know what you're communicating. You don't know what metaphors that language uses. You don't know the cultural baggage to what sentences you might be saying. And so, but I just think it took a lot longer than 2 years. It took 4, 5, or 6, you know, to really speak. Well, we were always learning. People always ask, like, so are you fluent? But I don't there was no way for us to live there long enough
right.
to really know everything. You know, our friends probably had 6 or 7 words for firewood, and I knew one.
Uh-huh.
You know, and so, like, and then you, like, there's bird vocabulary, right?
Wait, bird vocabulary?
Like, animals. Oh, like, okay. Whole sections of, like, we had to build a house while we were there, and so, you know, my husband, Alan, was the primary contractor in that time, so he learned all this construction vocabulary that he wouldn't have used otherwise. So, like, bird vocabulary, you know, dealing with birds was not really part of my job, so mm-hmm. I learned, you know, the word for eagle. And the generic bird word, and mm-hmm. I knew the word for owl, and maybe, like, swallow. But they had probably 20 other bird words. So, right. like, this is an example of, like, what do you call fluent, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But it was fun. I enjoy language learning, I feel like it opens up parts of reality that you didn't know could exist before. And so, like, in the Makua Meto language, to say that you miss someone, what you are literally saying, it's like a reflexive verb. And so you say, that person smells good to me. Mm-hmm. And it's just really sweet.
Yeah.
And, like, it makes you, you know, to hear someone say that and to learn how to kind of, it brings up how smell is connected to memory, you know, mm-hmm. every time we say it. Mm-hmm. And
the Irish, like the Gaelic language that Irish would speak, I didn't learn any of it. It's difficult. But it's very much a descriptive language, and a lot of words to mean one. Like, it takes a lot of words to say one thing. Like, the word for waves is something like white horse on the ocean, or I don't know. It's just That's very awesome. Poetic.
Yeah.
If you were to translate it word for word. Well, language is an interesting way to even think about creativity, I think. Like you're saying, the way that to say you miss someone, that's definitely a more creative way of saying it than how we would say it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's more descriptive, and it makes us, I feel like it stretches our brains to have to try and learn to think like other people. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure we never got all the way there,
mm-hmm.
But we got partway there. And so earlier stages, I think, of language learning is just like always doing translation in your head.
Right.
And I remember visiting the States in 2008. And that specific visit, I remember while we were in the States, I caught myself. So we were like in Tennessee, and we're talking to people. We're speaking English, but there was part of my brain in 2008 that was like sentence for sentence, continually still translating into Makua.
Uh-huh.
It's like I couldn't turn it off.
Yeah. How long had y'all been there at that point?
And so that was like the 3-year mark, yeah. you know, ish. But then I noticed, you know, we went back to Mozambique, and the next visit to the States, I think, was 2012. And that visit, it was gone. Like, it didn't do it. My brain stopped doing that, mm-hmm. and I noticed, like, I'm not translating anymore. I felt like there must be, like, levels. And probably, mm-hmm. like, some linguists would have a label for that, but.
Sure.
Yeah.
Did you ever dream? Did y'all ever dream in, like, other languages, you know, as you've been, like, language learning?
Sometimes I would have dreams that I could speak Spanish really well and understand everything. Sometimes I still have those dreams. I'll be like, I thought I forgot this. And then I'm just like rapid speaking Spanish. But it like makes sense in my dream, but it's not really, it's not real. Yeah. It's not me actually speaking real Spanish.
What about you, Rachel? Did you ever dream in Makua?
I think if it came into my dreams, it was like talking to so-and-so mm-hmm. kind of thing. Like if that happened that day or that week, like that conversation comes back up and I'm still having the conversation in my head. I think since we've moved back to the U.S., sometimes it will like come up like echoes from like a previous life. And so I'll try to think of a word. It's hard to be in the U.S., and seeing people visually while I'm speaking English to them and to, like, in that kind of situation, pull up Makua language in my mind, it doesn't work very well
mm-hmm.
while I'm here. And so sometimes I will like try to think of a word and I can't pull it up in my memory. But like a couple times this has happened where it will like pop up like 2 days later in a dream and like, oh, that's what that word was. We went back to visit this past summer. And that was just a huge gift. We're really grateful that we got to do that. And like, all the language came back. And we were a little bit worried because I literally cannot pull it up sometimes. Mm-hmm. Pull it up like I'm accessing a file or something, you know, in the back of my head.
In teaching, we call that schema. That's your mental files that you have in your brain.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know it had a name.
It does.
Awesome.
So do you and Alan ever speak it at home?
Only when we're trying to tell secrets.
Yeah. From the secret kids. Language.
Yeah. So the kids don't speak it.
The kids, we had the challenge of like it being a two language learning barrier.
Right.
And so like the adults on our team focused on both. But we felt like we had to choose for the kids. Like we don't have the resources or the time to make sure our kids do both. And so we had like a small school, small like group homeschooling, two room schoolhouse kind of thing, and we ended up choosing Portuguese for them, hoping it will, you know, do things in their brain, and you know they can learn Italian or French or Spanish later, and you know that the Portuguese will enable them to do that, or maybe they'll just keep using the Portuguese. Mm-hmm. It's more portable than Makua.
Sure.
There's, you know, chances are they're not going to go back there and live there and use that. So. But they just really spent time with Portuguese.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about creativity just a little bit. So, Rachel, I'm really interested. Are there any, like, avenues in your life that you like to explore creativity?
Yes. Let me tell you about
that. Please do.
I learned to sew when I was in junior high.
Okay.
And I learned to sew from a lady at church. I learned to sew on my mom's Kenmore that was almost as old as I was, just a few years younger than me.
Best way to sew.
Right.
It's so strange to me, too, that Kenmore makes sewing machines because they also make, like, washing machines.
Yeah. Washers and dryers and stuff. And so I have wondered, like, where this got into my head. And so my theory of why I loved this, I had a series of books, why I wanted to quilt. So I had a series of books that was kind of like a not well-known cousin of, like, Little House on the Prairie. Mm-hmm. It's, like, so same era, kind of, like, frontier living. But, like, it was called Grandma's Attic as this series. And not very well-known. But, like, the first couple books, it's a grandmother and a granddaughter. And there's quilts involved. And every square is related to some story in their family. And she tells the granddaughter the story of where that fabric came from. And it's just really
sweet, short
stories. And, like, I still have, I think, my original set of these books. And so they're totally, you know, fuzzy and worn on the edges. But I love those books. And so I don't know if that's where it got lodged in my memory. But, you know, all through my childhood and adolescence, I love the idea of quilting and how that stuff is pieced together and it all has stories. But it was all, like, down here in my heart or my gut. Like, I didn't ever talk about it like that in a sentence or anything. But got interested in quilts and thought they were really beautiful and, like, thought about, you know, in the back of my mind, like, I want to do that someday. And then started talking about it in, like, early adulthood maybe. We moved overseas when I was 25. So that would have been 2003. And it wasn't until 2009 that I really could make space in my schedule and my life for it. And so, like, I remind myself of that all the time. Anytime that I'm, like, currently naming something, I would like to learn how to do or be that thing, you know? Like, well, if it's at least 5 to 6 years that I said, I want to learn to quilt.
So you learned to quilt in Mozambique.
I did. I never took a class. I just sort of like, I know how to sew. What is quilting but sewing three layers together? So I made so many mistakes from not having had a class or somebody to tell me what to do. I just thought, I know how to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just did that. And so I was interested in bed quilts, but I was also just really interested in, like, art on the wall and, like, textile arts and fabric arts. And so I've done probably just as many, maybe more, art quilts on the wall as bed quilts. I don't know what the count is. There was one year where, I don't even remember what year this was, but it was several years into me, like, experimenting with quilting and teaching myself how to quilt. And I was like, it must have been a busy season. And so I remember feeling sad. And I was feeling sorry for myself because, like, I haven't been able to sew much lately. And just, so I was, like, writing my journal. I was just trying to name, like, everything I had sewed since mm-hmm. I really had started quilting. And it was, like, this huge number, like, 60-something. And
oh,
I was, like,
my goodness.
Okay, I'm going to stop feeling sorry for myself. This is just a busy season, yeah. And it's going to be okay.
I want to talk about just the practicality of sewing in Mozambique. One, did you bring a sewing machine from the States or you got one there?
I had my Kenmore. That was awesome. My mother's Kenmore.
So is there electricity the same, or did you have to use a converter?
Yeah, it was on a transformer, mm-hmm. and I'll say I'm not an electrical engineer, so I don't. Our electricity was not grounded.
Yeah.
And even when we were in like our third house, the one that we had to build, we tried to do what we thought would make the house grounded, and that still didn't work. So we, again, I'm not an electrician, mm-hmm. so I don't know everything I'm
Neither
talking
are we.
About,
but, so right. you could say it wrong.
But like,
and we
it
won't
seemed
know.
Like maybe the city electricity was also not grounded. So it was like my Kenmore was a metal sewing machine, but with like painted enamel.
Yes.
But it was old enough that there were a few spots where it had gotten dinged and like the mm-hmm. painted enamel had worn off. So the metal was exposed.
Mm-hmm.
So theoretically, even when that happens, if you're wearing shoes, you shouldn't get shocked, but I would still get shocked. So, like, little shocks.
You're like, tiny sewing machine shocks. Would give you, like, little, like, almost like static shocks right. where it's like, oh.
It didn't feel good. Yeah. But it wasn't terrible, but it didn't feel good.
I don't sew in shoes.
Well, see, yeah, I have to here.
Yeah, I typically don't either, but my sewing machine is way older than me. It's metal, covered yeah. in enamel. I never thought that that might happen.
Right. Right. So that would happen in the kitchen, too, with, like, the KitchenAid mixer. My kids knew that if they were going to touch one of the metal appliances, they needed to have shoes on. So I knew another friend who had, like, a mixer, a stand mixer in her kitchen, and she had taped the word shoes on the side of her mixer.
Wow. Yeah.
Because you get a zing.
Because even sewing machines all have just the two prong plugs anyway. They don't even have a grounding
for the most
pin.
Part. But my old sewing machine is from, I think it's technically Swedish. It does have a grounding pin.
I wonder your Bernina?
Mm-hmm.
Then I wonder if my Bernina does too.
I think it does.
But see, they had to be converted anyway from Europe uses 240 or 220, and we use 120.
Mm-hmm.
So we always.
Right.
I bought a machine in Ireland so that I didn't have to mess with using a power converter and the plug was right and all that.
Mm-hmm. My coworker started a craft group with women kind of and with some small business skills at the same time, taught them to sew, and then they ended up teaching like sewing some zipper pouches and aprons and like satchel type bags, and those sewing machines would come up from South Africa. So they were already set to run on 220.
Yeah. What about fabric and stuff? There was access?
Yeah, they had fabric in the market. It was usually imported from like Tanzania or Nigeria, okay. but a lot of really busy prints, bright colors. In the early, but also it just seemed like there were like trends, like for all the early years, like there was never anything red, hardly at all. Mm. Lots of yellows and greens and blacks. And obviously those are fine. But it was like, where's the red? Like we can't expand the palette. But at some point, you know, I don't know who controls the production mm-hmm. in Tanzania and Nigeria, but at some point we started getting like more reds in. And sometimes there's more like just giant patterns or giant. Like designs and then
like more for clothing.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of it's for clothing. Our friends, the women that we knew, so generally would wear, like a shirt, that is like secondhand. So like secondhand clothing from the industrialized countries, like that doesn't sell mm-hmm. like at Goodwill or like mass produced T-shirts for the team that didn't win the championship. Mm-hmm. Like those kinds of, that gets baled like hay, like used clothing and like shipped over on containers, and it's bought and sold by the bale and then gets sold in markets there. So shirt from the market that's, you know, used from another country, and then fabric, they'd have like, a lot of times they'd have like some sort of slip or thin skirt, and then they'd have one or two or three like wraps of fabric around them, and like it's tucked the way that our friends did it where we lived. They did not tie it. They had this like elaborate like tucking that all just felt like it always stayed on, and it felt like there's no way I'm gonna do that because I will never, it would never stay tucked.
Yeah.
For me, so I wasn't brave to like do the wrap skirt just like them because I just knew it was going to fall off. Huh. But they had several wrapped. Usually they had a wrap on their head as well. But the extra skirt, you know, your third or fourth wrap skirt, you know, if you go visit your friend and they decide to share a kilo of their beans with you, then you automatically take off your outer layer and you wrap up, you know, your beans that you were just given, and then you can carry it home on your head.
I so love that.
It's very multi-purpose.
It sounds very hot.
So, okay, but here's the thing. As a person who wears a lot of layers in warmer weather, like the more covered you are, the more like the sun is kept off of you. So oftentimes, like I'm wearing a petticoat and a slip underneath all of my dresses, and people are like, aren't you hot in all of those layers? And as long as they are natural fibers, it breathes very easily. So a lot of these bold fabrics, cotton, I'm sure if it's cotton, then yes, there is some weight to it, but it keeps the sun off of your skin and keeps you cooler. Not like AC, like not like, you know, you got a fan underneath there, but it's like not as bad. Now, I can only speak to my experience being in hot weather, but it's not as bad as you think.
It just sounds smothering to me. We all know how I feel about hot weather, though. What was the general attitude toward creativity in Mozambique?
That's a great question. I think it would be different depending on who you talk to. There was a linguistic group, like a people group north of us called the Makonde, and they were known for being carvers. And there were a few Makonde carvers in our town. But if you ask that question about creativity and kind of explain what you mean, probably people would point to Makonde carvers as what they know about. Or they may have someone in their village that makes baskets for like sifting grain or something like that.
Would people pick up hobbies there? Or is it like everyone's just busy
like living life?
Right. Like doing your life takes too much time to have hobbies.
Yeah. Most of our friends were subsistence farmers. So we lived in like the most remote province.
Okay.
And so so it was a really rural feel to life. So that being said, it was actually, we were in the county seat is the best way to describe it, the district capital. And so our town probably had 70 or 80,000 people in it. So it was, but it had a small town feel. So most everybody was still doing subsistence farming and walking out during the farming season, walking out to their farms. and so you were lucky if you actually got a job because there was not much of a job market there. And so hobbies as far as what people do for fun. I think now for the younger generations with urbanization, there's a little bit more access to like media, like movies and videos and the internet. But that changed even the 15 years while we were there.
Right.
So that really barely existed in the first few years. So I think trying to explain your question of creativity and hobbies, it would take a long time to explain there. I think people like to, I think conversation is a game there, and it's kind of a hobby. People love to shoot the breeze, and they love for it to take as long as possible. They love visiting people, and they love being visited by people. And And so I think that could definitely be named as like what people like to do for fun. We learned even like in interacting with traffic cops, I think is a demonstration of like that this is kind of like their favorite pastime, their favorite game. You know, here in the U.S., if you get stopped by a police officer mm-hmm. for a traffic violation, it's usually expected that it's all business.
Oh, if it's not, then something is going wrong.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what's the problem?
Yeah.
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
Do you know why I pulled you over today?
Right. All business. But there, if I did all business, you know, at a traffic stop, they would totally suspect that something was going on.
Oh, they're like,
instead, oh, what works well is like, how are you? And this is someone I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a stranger.
Did you have many traffic stop violations?
It's really, they're not based on violations. Okay. It's usually, so like 2 hours.
Just see Rachel speeding all over the place.
It's,
it's
pretty routine. Traffic cops were not the same as other police officers.
Okay.
So routine stops to check the car registration documents okay. and the driver's license okay. stuff and make sure everything's up to date. So the traffic officer is a stranger, I don't know, and it's more like, good morning, how yes. are you? How's your mother?
Oh, yeah.
Are your kids healthy? Did it rain here?
Okay.
You know, like that kind of like, and you know, however they answer, you know, just let the conversation go as long as you want. And that, like, it shows respect. It shows, I think, like a, in some ways, like some like human dignity, like
yeah,
an
there's
awareness
like a humanity
that
this, in that.
This is what people love.
Yeah.
And but if you did that here
to a police officer, right. they'd be like, oh, what is going on
Something
here?
Something is wrong with
They're
you.
They're trying to stall.
Or even if you did that with like the cash register, whoever's checking you out at the cash register, right. if you're like, how's your mother? They'd be like, do I know you?
Okay. But here,
right.
I will give a caveat here. I am the child of a very loquacious father, and I have several friends that are like this as well, where they never meet a stranger.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And so we go places and they ask the, you know, the servers their name. Sometimes they get in a little bit of personal conversation. And I have started to do that as well, where I'm like, you know, I'm standing next to a person that I don't know at this wedding that I will never see again. And I'm like, hey, how you doing? You got kids? You got pictures? Mm-hmm. You know, tell me a little bit about yourself.
Right.
And my husband is like, you get too deep too fast. And I was like, I just like people. And like, I love what you said about conversations being almost mm-hmm. like a game and a creative experience. I think also in, at least in my Southern small town experience, we love to visit and we love to sit around a table over food or a game and just talk for hours right. on end and just visit. And to people on the outside, they think that's really boring or like that we just quote gossip, but it's how we interact with each other. And storytelling is one of the oldest creative pursuits, right? Crafting the perfect narrative,
right?
Even in conversation or on a page. So I love that they're just like with everybody, they just want to have this fun conversation.
And like, I feel like there's creativity involved in like anytime you have to learn, especially anytime you have to learn something outside your comfort zone. So what we're talking about here, like just sort of the art mm-hmm. of small talk. I was not good at that
yeah.
when we learned there, when we moved there. I learned about myself when we moved there that I think I'm like a borderline introvert. I didn't know that about myself
yeah.
until we moved to a very communal-based society, and we were kind of in our first years of having small children, and so there's no breaks.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that situation, realized, I think I might be an introvert. Oh, no, I didn't know that, and I had to come to terms with that and kind of get to know myself again in this new stage of life. And all this is happening while we're trying to learn two languages
and becoming parents as well, right, at the same time.
So there's
time.
A lot of learning going on. And I realized, like, it takes small talk, mm-hmm, to get to know people when you're learning language and you've just shown up and you don't know anybody. You have, you know, 200 acquaintances, mm-hmm, and you're not close to anybody. And so you have to start with small talk to learn the language and to eventually with the goal of like actually knowing people deeply. And so I had to practice, mm-hmm, something that I really didn't feel like I was naturally good at. And, you know, talk with friends or acquaintances, you know, hopefully one day friends, but talk with people in town and say, with my, you know, language learning skills, you know, I talked to my mother on the phone yesterday and she told me that my brother got a new bike. And just like learn how to say, yeah, that, mm-hmm, in other languages, but having to talk down the introvert in the back of my head who was saying, they do not care that your brother got a new bike and that your mom told you on the phone. Like I had to like push through that and just learn how to do that. Mm-hmm. And, but it was a beautiful skill and I'm really glad that I did learn that. And so I think you mentioned storytelling. Mm-hmm. I think one art form that does exist there would be storytelling. There was a traditional storyteller north of our town that we got to know in the last few years we were there. And it was almost like Aesop's Fables. So, like, animal stories, like the crafty rabbit, mm-hmm, or the mosquito who's so small but can disrupt the more powerful big animals, and, like, these social commentary-type stories. Mm-hmm. But it was also it had, like, a rhythm and a flow, and it was kind of sing-songy.
Ooh, yes.
And it was really – it was so cool to listen to and we wished we had like gotten to know him like earlier in our time, mm-hmm, there, but it was just really beautiful to watch. And there, when you'd get to the end of one short story, there would be this like, there's usually a secondary storyteller who would be kind of like the, there's probably a word for this, but
like an apprentice?
Kind of like an apprentice and kind of like a sidekick who like almost like would hold up the sign for applause in a current talk show, but not like, but more like do this like humming thing to kind of signal that that story's over. And like then his like humming word would trigger the audience, their response. So a little bit of a call and response. Mm. And then they would all say this word like, Saminia, and it's like this like tonal like word that basically is the word for like an oil lamp. Mm. And the day that we were there really listening and recording hours of this, it was daytime.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that word came from when storytelling tended to be like a nighttime thing. Mm-hmm. And so, and it basically, it meant like light the lamp, keep the lamp lit, let's keep going. Like, oh, it's just
like,
really
like
sweet.
Encore. We right. want more.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Oh, I love that.
It's really sweet. And this guy was really great. So he would be his normal, regular self, you know, father, dad, neighbor. His name was Hihapusia. But when it was time to do storytelling, he had a hat and he put on it. Kind of, I don't know where he got it. We never got to ask him that, but I don't know if he got it in the market, mm-hmm, just like from, you know, like baled used clothing. Like, yeah, this is a bale of hats. Who knows where he got this hat, but it looked like a jester's hat. Like, it had kind of the,
yeah, like the two, like, or four little four, curved,
yeah,
things that come with down.
The bells on?
I can't remember if it had bells or tassels. Like, I don't remember it making noise. So maybe there were little balls or pom poms, but, when he put on the hat, he was in the storyteller mode. But so other like creativity and hobbies, like kids had games,
mm-hmm,
you know, like they had versions of the Moncala game where like you're moving the different, mm-hmm, seeds in the, mm-hmm, holes in the sand. And like Ayesi was like the game where they're like two sides and they're racing to fill the bottle with sand. And
oh, nice.
So as far as like hobbies and playfulness, and but mostly it was conversation, I think.
I love that, because there definitely is a specific art form to the art of conversation, and it's something that has to happen in a group. It can't just be something that happens on its own, and it's something that, you know, everyone participates in. And oftentimes, like, the creativity that we have here in the States is very isolated. Oh, I paint by myself, or I write songs or stories. And the only time that we get to share those things is like when we become that storyteller and then we share with our audience. And oftentimes the only like interaction that we get with them, it might only be through social media because we post a picture, or it might only be through like, you know, sharing with our family. And some, you know, it can be kind of a gamble there as to whether or not it goes well. But I love that picture of this interactive storytelling going on, and everyone kind of knows the flow of how that goes. That's just so interesting to me.
Our friends there, even just their normal conversation style, tended to be more indirect. And there were like proverbs or analogies or metaphors involved. And, you know, if you and I were going to have a conversation about a problem in the community, their preference would be to, you know, tell a parable or a metaphor or analogy. And like, it's this indirect way of coming around to maybe a place of dialogue or approaching a solution. And I knew that. And that's not natural for me. And so it was, that came more naturally to my husband. But I feel like that was something I was always learning the whole time I was there. And I definitely, like, I attempted it. I was learning it. I was trying it. But I always felt like if you were trying to, like, learn how to rollerblade and you didn't know how, you would feel awkward. So, like, the awkwardness of learning, like, I feel
like your muscles are not in quite the right place, and it just feels, ugh.
Yeah, I don't have the muscle memory of this yet. So me learning to try and be more indirect, because that's valued in that culture. I was trying and I was learning, but I still felt the awkwardness of the lack of muscle memory in that, like, the whole time I was there. So it's not like everybody's all the same there. It's not exactly
No one's
fair.
Like a monolith, right? Where it's like, oh, they all loved doing this. I'm sure there's introverts over there that were like, oh, this is not my thing.
And definitely had some friends that were, more like snarky, to the point, and just like, I'm going to say it like it is. And so, but that was more rare. So.
Wow. That's so cool. Well, thank you for sharing that lovely story with us. I'm a little interested, Joe, in how creativity manifests itself over in Ireland. Like, I think we assume because they speak English that, like, oh, they must be just like us. But were there some differences that you noticed about how they approached maybe creative hobbies, or like, were there similarities perhaps with, like, you know, elements of storytelling or conversation that Rachel shared with us?
I think that the Irish in general are very creative. So as a, like, that was kind of what I was wanting to hear, what your experience, Rachel, was in Mozambique, like the cultural attitude to creativity. And in Ireland, I think they really value creativity. So whether it's something like river dance, and, you know, Irish dancing, which they would do, I mean, they like learn that in school, and it's
like everybody had to do it.
I think so. I mean, I was not a student, nor did I have children in school there, but it's very much appreciated, like just the folklore aspect.
Wait,
of,
do you know how to river dance?
No.
I would like, this should be a video to get you to demonstrate.
Like the aspect they have of folklore, or even Irish, learning Irish as they have to learn it in school. And they may, I think to be a teacher there, you have to speak Irish.
Like Gaelic? Or is there a difference between Gaelic and the Irish
language? I think Gaelic is probably like what Rachel was saying about Makua, and then there's different dialects. But no one in Ireland calls it Gaelic. They call it Irish.
Okay.
So I don't know if it's the same type of Gaelic that you would speak in Scotland.
No, I think I was in Scotland for a very minute mm-hmm. amount of time, especially in comparison to y'all's time. But yeah, the Irish, or not the Irish, the Scottish called it Gaelic. Mm-hmm. Like they even pronounced it differently. Yeah.
But in Ireland, they call it Irish.
Speaking Irish.
Lots of things made out of wool. So like felting, knitting. I would say probably more knitting than crochet, but also a lot of felting. Felted hats, felted purses. Some of my teammates and I did craft fairs while we were there, and our tables looked so different. Like, they didn't know what to do with fabric crafts. Like, with
Oh, because what were you putting out?
Okay, we were doing, stuff with fabric. Quilts, mm-hmm. pillows. Denise made, like, little dresses and stuff yeah. and these little dolls out of fabric, but they would be a lot more like felted hats,
things scarves, that are knitted. Knitwear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think it gets dark so early there in the winter that I think that creative hobbies are just a part of their culture more than they are.
It was here. A necessity because it got dark. And so what are you going to do?
And it is still very rural and agricultural, farming, sheep farming, herding.
Sheep. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. And so it is manual labor that a lot of people are doing, but then they also just have this, everyone's very musical.
Mm.
So they definitely had more, I think more so than America does, like a national creative culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't know what to say that is for America. Like, I wouldn't necessarily say, oh, the people from the United States are so creative. I guess I should call it the United States, not America.
Yeah.
Because I think other places in the continent of America are more creative than we are. But
yes.
And maybe it's because it's so small, so it's easier when you have 4 million people to have...
to kind of make a generalization.
Right. Versus however 260 million or however many live in the States. So.
Yeah, I would say that from my own lived experience, the South has a sort of river of creativity that runs through it. There's a lot of emphasis, especially in smaller towns, placed on like homemade goods, especially baked goods, mm-hmm. and often like crafting things for like special occasions. You know, like making that cute little baby dress for your first baby, or, you know, making a baby blanket, like things like that we still do that we cherish. But as far as like trying to pick out like, oh yes, you know, the United States are really creative in this manner. Again, it comes back to that we're very individualistic mm-hmm. here. And so that, you know, sharing in a storytelling time doesn't really happen here.
Well, and they very much have pub culture there where, you know, you like go to the pub at night and someone's playing live music or someone
That just sounds so fun.
Yeah. It's just different. Like, I think if there was an Irish character in a story, mm-hmm. you would not be surprised if they were a little bit like
if they could sing
jolly,
a little bit,
yeah,
like carry a tune.
Right.
Maybe
they're like always whistling.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Yeah. That's very fascinating.
What are some of your other questions?
Okay. Yes. So, I wanted to ask specifically, because your girl's food-driven, if there was any creativity that y'all experienced, like, through food, through making food, through the way that you experienced how cultures made food.
I did not like Irish food. It's like meat and potatoes, and that
like,
is
that's it.
And their definition...
Is there some cabbage in there? Or
their,
some...
like, idea of... Well, root vegetables, fine.
Yeah.
Their idea of spices is, like, garlic and salt and pepper. So then, if I made anything... spicy, like they just couldn't handle it. I wasn't. Now their food, like their dairy, is top notch and their bread is really good, but I did not enjoy Irish cuisine.
Mm-hmm.
You can only eat shepherd's pie and be impressed so many times.
So you would say that they like hung on to a lot of these like staples. You would say they ate a lot of the same things.
I mean, I was in Dublin. It's very metropolitan.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I wasn't like eating in Irish households very much, but like I did not like their take on desserts. Like I never, if
what
someone
is
was
their
like,
take on desserts? I'm interested.
The
now.
Only thing I liked was pavlova, which is like a baked meringue, like a big meringue with fruit and cream and stuff on top. I liked that, but their cakes were dry. They used a lot of marzipan.
Oh, marzipan, isn't that like crushed almond paste or something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, it's kind of like fondant the way it is on top of cakes. So I just didn't appreciate Irish desserts.
But you didn't get to like cook with anybody who was Irish or like get to...
I mean, I ate at people's houses, but I wasn't like, let me come into your kitchen and cook with you.
No, well, that's fair. But
so right. No.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, I guess they get creative with how many different ways they can make potatoes.
That's true. I think back to that quote from Lord of the Rings where Sam is like talking about all the ways you can prepare potatoes and probably has some Irish roots there. Mm-hmm. Tolkien probably took some from some of that.
Yeah. Was he not? Wasn't he?
I believe he was English technically.
Because he was in that group with C.S. Lewis. Yes. And what was their group called?
Oh, I have no idea.
Not the Groundlings, that's a comedy group in California. I'll think of it later. They had like, they all met at a pub and they had a name for their group.
Oh man, I didn't know this. Oh, now I'm very interested.
Was it Inklings?
Yes.
Inklings? The Inklings. I love that.
I hope I'm right. My oldest is going to be really proud of me if I got that
right.
Yeah,
I think maybe that is right.
Yeah. Yep. My oldest was at Hobbiton like yesterday and she took her elf ears.
Oh, like in New Zealand, yes. Right? Oh my goodness. It's beautiful there.
It is. But I had to learn a lot about food and cooking in Mozambique. We couldn't get a lot of like ingredients that we were used to. So we had to improvise a lot. But my favorite thing is like greens. Oh. Our friends grew a lot of greens, like mustard greens or collard greens or different varieties of greens. Never had that growing up.
Mm-mm.
But so I went through the insecurity of like having small children and like, am I a good mom? And like that stage of life while I was like trying to figure out what does like healthy food look like, and I'm in this new country and I'm still trying to learn things. And you know, my childhood, if you were gonna feed your children vegetables, it was green beans. Mm-hmm. You know, and like this was hard to get there, and I was just like, I had this like hidden resentment against green beans because like they weren't there and it was hard to do. And anyway,
I love
just
that.
Like,
I can't stand green beans.
I feel like not a good southerner when I say that. I feel like I like
nah, the Southern girl's with you.
Not admitted to the club or something. But, like, I just was like, these greens are so good. And so I kind of learned to cook over there and trying to put greens in almost anything. There's, like, this superfood that in English is called moringa. I think that's what people call it in English. And
yeah, because you can make like tea and stuff. They use it as like a powder here.
Right. So it's grown and the leaves are dried and then powdered and you can get it as powder or capsules or whatever. But like it grows as people's fence posts in Mozambique because it grows really straight.
Oh.
The trunk is super straight and will last for years. And so if you trim it, it can get super tall. But if you trim it, then the branches will stay down pretty low and in reach. And they just cook it as like another kind of greens. The leaves are really tiny, so it's not like collard greens that you would chop up and cook as greens.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be a little bit sour or bitter depending on like your palate.
Mm-hmm.
But I really liked it. Our friends viewed it as like sometimes they were embarrassed to feed that to us because like you want to show hospitality. A lot of times they would want to give the best thing.
Oh yeah,
we
got the best stuff
to offer to your guests. But like at Moringa, locally it's called Ninkeru, but like it was kind of like the last straw. Like if I don't have anything else, this is all I have to feed my family or my guests. And so sometimes if we got fed that, it would come with an apology. It's like, sorry, this is all we have. But I really liked it.
Yeah.
And we ate it the whole time we were there. And, you know, at some point during that 15 years, people start telling us, actually, like, that thing you've got there, that's moringa that people are selling for, like, high prices in, like, American health food stores. And
oh, my goodness.
I think some of our friends believed us. I think some of our friends were like,
You're just telling a story.
You're just joking. Yeah. This, you know, this is the thing that, this is our last resort type mm-hmm. food. But we got offered some weird stuff, like caterpillars or I'm drawing a blank.
And is it rude if you didn't eat it? Like, would you eat the caterpillar?
In general. Like, in general is rude, but, like, it was so rare that sometimes when something weird, strange got offered, strange like that got offered to us, there would be kind of like a wink and a chuckle, like hey, you want to try this too? Mm-hmm. And the few times that happened, there was usually something else being served as well. And so I got served toad once. I actually got served some like rancid elephant meat just once. Wow. We ate like, and I know we got served one form of monkey one time and one form of like hyrax, which is kind of like picture a bunny, but not soft and like short ears. But like lives on
so some sort
mountains.
Of rodent.
Yeah, large bunny
like stuff so, that's meat like that. I can be like, okay, right. Monkey is like meat,
right?
But caterpillar is a bug.
We also got served rat. A few times, and cooked in a few different ways. But like, you could only in their culture, you do not eat rats in your house. That you caught in your house.
Oh,
you
yeah.
Only
oh.
eat field rats. Like, that was a specific category. But we didn't get into it. Like,
what would you do with rat? Like, were rats in your house a common thing? Did you have rats in your house?
Yes.
What did you catch them and take them to the field?
No. We the years that we had a dog, the dog could help us catch it. One of Alan's favorite stories that he tells anyone who will listen is about, because Alan grew up playing Little League in Texas and he loves baseball. And there was one time where like the night guard was with him, like came into the house and like they've cornered a rat in a room. And the rat like climbed up a floor fan, like a tall stand mm-hmm. fan, and kind of like leapt into the air. And Alan, all he had was a broom handle, and he like swung. He tells the story the same way with the same phrases every time.
Uh-huh.
And then all the years of Little League came back, and he like swung into it and hit a line drive and like killed the rat that way. So
whoa.
That would be a more creative way to do it. But usually the dog got the rat faster than we would. So
and they would dispatch the rat.
Yes,
I had to kill a rat that was in my backyard that Pip was playing with.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And I ran over it with my car because I didn't know how else to kill it.
You left out that part when you told it to me.
Oh, then I didn't. Then, no, this was a second rat.
Oh, my goodness.
And I don't think that bringing a hammer down or a shovel down on a rat is an approved PT activity.
PETA or,
no,
oh, PTS in your.
I don't care about that.
For a you mean your shoulder? Okay.
Yeah. So, well, when I say I don't care about PETA, I mean we should be nice to animals. I don't think that a rat. I wanted to be humane, but yes. I don't think it was PT approved to be raising a shovel over my head and slamming it down on a rat. So I ran over it with my car. Do we want to keep talking? It's been a long time.
If y'all still have some more to say.
Well, then let's make this be part one.
All right. Excellent.
And so bye for now, and we will catch you next week for part two.
Bye.
Thank you to my dear, dear friend Craig Hudson for our very createful theme music. You can hear more of Craig's music on Spotify under Craig Hudson, that's Hudson with a T, or you can just click on the link in the show notes. Also, be sure to connect with Make Do on Instagram at Make Do Create or on Facebook at Make Do Cersei, and visit our website, makedocreate.org, for upcoming classes, show notes, to order a face mask, lots of things. We'll be back here with another episode next Monday. Have a good week, y'all.